This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist Walt Handelsman, now with the New Orleans and Baton Rouge Advocate, formerly with Newsday and the Times-Picayune. Walt Handelsman will talk about the craft of cartoon writing. Also on the show, we'll talk with Edward Pratt. He, too, writes for The Advocate, as he has for many years, and is the public relations director for Southern University. And Ed Pratt had a column a few days ago about Richard Sherman getting a raw deal. This was before the Super Bowl, and the big beatdown is Seattle blasted Denver 43-8. We'll talk with Ed Pratt about Richard Sherman and also about the newest Pro Football Hall of Famer from Southern University, Aeneas Williams. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, please call 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our guest to start our week is Walt Handelsman, native of Baltimore, editorial cartoonist for the New Orleans and Baton Rouge Advocate. He was with the New Orleans Times-Picayune from 1989 to 2001, then went to work for Newsday, and a few months ago returned home. He's in New Orleans in his studio as he joins us this morning. And good morning to you, Walt Handelsman, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing well. Now, you graduated from Dean College in Franklin, Maryland, with an associate degree in art therapy. Is that correct?
It's in Massachusetts, and yes.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Well,
kind of limped into college. Was not a great high school student. Was more interested in the artwork than the heavy lifting, and went into a two-year program that they considered it, it was called art therapy. I didn't think that it was really a good fit for me, but I did finish it and came out of there with all of the requirements needed for a two-year degree, and went on to work in an ad agency over the summer, where I really sort of fell in love with the idea of getting a job using the artistic skills and love and desire to be creative that I had.
And your first gig as an editorial cartoonist came shortly thereafter, didn't it?
Well, I went on to the University of Cincinnati, where I graduated with a bachelor's degree. And then I moved back to Baltimore with a degree in advertising/general studies and got a full-time job at an ad agency. So that's really where I started not being a cartoonist. There's really no clear path for becoming a cartoonist. I know most of the cartoonists in the country, and all of them come from different paths. Some of them drew cartoons at like Disney World type places, and others were political science majors that knew how to doodle. My route was to go through, as I say, I worked in advertising, and I basically decided I really wanted to do this. I had done a little bit of cartooning at the college newspapers, and I would come home every night after my job and sit down in my room at my parents' house. I was just a kid, and really taught myself how to draw cartoons, and more importantly, how to come up with punchlines and how to synthesize the news down. So it all started, I would say, my first job at a chain of weeklies came in about 1982.
And then it was on to, I think, the Scranton Times in Pennsylvania.
Yes, in 1985 I got my first job as a daily cartoonist, which was a lot of fun and a big step for me. My wife and I moved from Maryland to Pennsylvania, and I worked at my first daily newspaper, which was an absolute blast. Paper was about 65,000 circulation. And Scranton was a very nice town. It was a small city in coal country in Pennsylvania. The people were fantastic. The paper had a long history, and it was great. It was a great job. I worked there for 4 years until the job opened up at the Times-Picayune, and I applied for that job and was fortunate enough to get it and moved down here.
Your number is 297-5633. The guest is Walt Handelsman, editorial cartoonist, two-time Pulitzer winner, also the author of seven collections of his editorial cartoons, as well as a children's book. And he became a Louisiana transplant in 1989, stayed a dozen years with the Times-Picayune, and I guess you know as well as anybody that New Orleans is rather fertile for the kind of work you do.
That's an understatement. And it's not just New Orleans. It's the whole state has always been a great place. I like to think that the license plate, my license plate should say that, cartoonist paradise. It's just it's an amazing place to be a cartoonist. It's nonstop, interesting stuff, you know, great stuff to do social commentary on, so many interesting and fascinating people, and then, you know, the politics is just unbelievable, and never-ending craziness, which is perfect for cartooning.
Walt Handelsman has been in and out of New Orleans now for a quarter century, and he's doing his stuff across the country, and he's based right here in our midst, and he, as I stated, he's in his studio right now in New Orleans, and we'll get to some of his work in of recent vintage and past, but what makes a good editorial cartoonist?
I think, you know, when I speak to students quite a bit, and what I try and stress to them is that it really isn't the artwork. If you can do fun artwork that people enjoy looking at, that's a bonus. But the most important thing about an editorial cartoon is the message or the punchline. Trying to synthesize down big, complex issues into very easily understood concepts is the key. So I spend the vast majority of my day just thinking and staring at a blank piece of paper or making notes or doodling or trying to generate an idea. I mean, I have a list in front of me today of topics that I may want to draw a cartoon about, from Groundhog Day to what happened in the Super Bowl yesterday to immigration issues, and I've just started making a list, and then I just sort of stare at it. So I think the thing that makes a good cartoon is something that is instantly understandable and has a point of view, is very, very funny or is clever and has an impact. I think that's basically the task every day.
How many do you do a year on average?
I probably do between 250 and 300 cartoons a year. Mm-hmm. The Advocate, right now I'm doing four cartoons a week, and then I'm doing a monthly animation for their website, which is a whole separate deal in terms of the type of work and how many hours it takes. And then we're also going to do some contests. We're just about to kick off in the next couple of weeks some stuff that your listeners might enjoy. We're going to do some fill-in-the-word contests. So I draw a cartoon of some kind of a wacky scene, leave the word balloon open, and then people can write their own punchlines and win prizes. And I think the winner is going to have their punchline hand-lettered into the cartoon and printed in the paper and online, and they'll get a signed print of the cartoon with their punchline in it. I've done it in the past, and it's generally a fun thing to do. People like to think that they can write funny punchlines many times they can, and it's challenging and fun. So there'll be a lot of drawing aside from the four cartoons a week.
You referred to the Super Bowl. I think it was you. You referred to it as the Pot Bowl.
I did. I really wanted to come up with some kind of funny cartoon about the Super Bowl for yesterday's newspaper. And there were so many, you know, in these days with the Internet, the job is very different than it was when I started out, where you basically read a newspaper or two and came up with ideas, and you never really saw what other cartoonists had done or what late night comics were doing or funny jokes people were putting online, whether it's on Facebook or on Twitter. But now you basically see everything. It's being blasted at you if you spend enough time on the internet, and I spend a lot of time on the web for my job. So I really wanted to try and come up with something a little bit different for the Super Bowl. I mean, you know, one of my thoughts was, what I generally try and do with a cartoon is I think, how do I really feel about something? I'm a very, very, I'm a diehard Saints fan. And we spent years in New York, and my whole family went to the sports bar every week with our Saints stuff on and, you know, did the Who Dat chant, and we were really big Saints fans. So my first thought was perhaps I could do something about what it's like to watch the Super Bowl when your team isn't in it, because it's really not that big a deal. I mean, it's just a football game. But I couldn't help but think about the fact, and it had been brought up many, many times, that both of the teams were from states with legalized pot. So I tried, and I finally came up with an idea that I thought was pretty funny about the various types of calls the referees would have to make. And just put those two pieces of the puzzle together and came up with a cartoon. So that was fun.
I think Walt's the only guy to put those two together. 297-5633, Bruce and Walden. Bruce, you're on the air with Walt Handelsman. Hi, Bruce.
Yeah, hi, Jim. Yeah, I just saw a wonderful documentary about Herb Bloch, whose cartoons were really instrumental in bringing Nixon down. And I'm wondering if your guest has an example of perhaps how his political satire has really had an effect.
What about political satire?
Well, I saw that documentary as well, and Herb Bloch was an incredible, incredible talent and a masterful cartoonist. You know, I've done several cartoons in my career that I thought were strong cartoons. I can't really point to one that says, you know, I obviously didn't bring down a president or a mayor or a governor. But a series of cartoons during the Duke election here in Louisiana. I just thought it was unbelievable that David Duke could get the kind of support that he was getting in the early 90s. I did several cartoons about police corruption in New Orleans when I was here. Lots of cartoons about pension issues and union issues when I was in New York, where there was just a runaway. I mean, the tax base was so expensive to live there, and that was something that not only I, but the paper pounded away at on a fairly regular basis. You know, I would say that, you know, part of the job of a cartoonist is to point out when politicians or people in power have done something or are attempting to do something that is wrong, and I try and do that whenever I can. I think that, that cartooning in general has transformed in many ways in terms of the type of messaging that we do, as opposed to when Herb Bloch was a cartoonist. His stuff was very biting. Cartoonists today, many of them tend to be try and get their message across with a little bit more of humor and satire. But I did see that documentary, and I would recommend it. It was an absolutely fascinating look at this guy's life.
We're talking with Walt Handelsman, the editorial cartoonist now for the New Orleans and Baton Rouge Advocate. He does about 250 cartoons per year, and we will talk with him some more about some of the targets that are visible now, including the President of the United States, and some past targets. He was at the New Orleans Times-Picayune, Walt Handelsman was, from 1989 to 2001, and he's back in New Orleans now. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. 877-217-5757, back in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Frank Barnett producing. 297-5633, your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. Engster Show at WRKF.org. Walt Handelsman, the guest, the twice awarded Pulitzer Prize winner, back in Louisiana with the Baton Rouge and New Orleans Advocate. Now, to get a Pulitzer, Walt, what do you have to do? Do you submit one or a series of your work? What do you do?
You do a series of cartoons or a body of work. So they ask you to send in 20 cartoons. And so that's what you do. And I was fortunate enough to win a Pulitzer Prize for the Picayune in 1997. And that was 20 black and white static or standard editorial cartoons. I began doing animation in New York for Newsday's website, and they began allowing web animation, if you will. I believe it was in 2007, and so I submitted my work from the year of 2006, 10 standard editorial cartoons, and then 10 animations, and that was what I won my second Pulitzer Prize for, and that was really the first time that anyone had won Pulitzer for animation. So that was very exciting. Both of them were extremely exciting moments and very humbling.
Well, sure. It's not bad to win a Pulitzer every 10 years or so. President Obama, is he an easy guy to do cartoons?
Oh, I mean, he's easy enough to draw. I think, he's certainly given me plenty of stuff to draw cartoons about, and I have drawn plenty of cartoons. I think one of the things that's interesting, at least from my perspective on my work, is that I tend to get blasted both from the left and from the right, which I wear as a badge of honor, because I really feel there are lots and lots of cartoonists that I think are very dogmatic in their point of view. They are a liberal or they are a conservative, and they will look at issues through that lens, and I try very hard not to do that. I try and look at these issues, each one, and say, well, you know, what's the right thing? I mean, what is the right thing for the country? Not necessarily, not at all, for the party. I don't care about parties. What I care about is people being honest and trying to do the best that they can. And when there are missteps or things that I think are, I wouldn't want to say lies, but when I think that they're exaggerating or twisting, I am happy to pick on them. So I've picked on the president lots and lots of times. Most recently, I think the rollout of the Obamacare was a disaster and an embarrassment. So I had fair amount of fun with that. At the same time, I think that on the other side of the ledger, you have Republicans that have not worked very well with the president for various reasons, and so their party is in a nice way to say would be they're in a constant state of battling within themselves. So it tends to leave, as I said in the beginning of this paragraph, that what's best for the country. And I think the government in Washington fighting with each other and not moving, not addressing issues is terrible. And I think, obviously, if you look at the polls, not only of Obama's polls, but of Congress's polls, people would agree. So, all the presidents that I've drawn, going back to Ronald Reagan, have been fun targets for various reasons, interesting to draw. I've got a couple of letters from George Bush Sr. He was big on writing notes, and I actually got a call from the White House while I was sitting in my office at the Times-Picayune I had drawn a cartoon about him and Saddam Hussein right before the first Gulf War, and he saw the cartoon and wanted a copy of it, and I was amazed that I had gotten a call. I actually thought it was a prank call, so that was kind of interesting, and he ended up sending me a signed copy of the cartoon, and I sent him a signed copy, and he sent me some other cool stuff that I have framed in my office. So that was interesting, and back in the day, the cartoonist conventions used to go to the White House, so we had an opportunity to go see Ronald Reagan speak in the Rose Garden to a group of cartoonists. But all of them have offered ample fodder for cartooning in their presidencies, all of them.
Well, one that President Obama is quite unlikely to ask you to sign is one recently. It says, we're going to completely revamp the U.S. healthcare system. And then Obama, we're going to change the healthcare system. And then we're going to tweak healthcare. And finally, Band-Aid anyone?
Well, I mean, one of the things that's fun to point out, I mean, the rhetoric is always way off base with all these guys. I mean, they're politicians. That's what they do. And so what I do is, you know, you read the stories that are when that story came out, and, you know, you look at the high, the goals that they've set, and then the political reality sets in, and you just have to laugh because they're not getting what they're wanting. I watched the Bill O'Reilly interview with the president last night, and I mean, the president's very smart, and he's very, you know, he's a lawyer. And when you listen to him, the way that he answers some of the questions, he does what all politicians do. He's uncomfortable about some of the questions, and he kind of dodges around them. And so when, you know, when in that particular cartoon they talk about we're going to change everything and we're going to, everyone's going to be covered, and then that doesn't happen. I mean, that's not what happens, and perhaps over time it will happen. But it is really fun to sort of, you know, pop the bubble, if you will, of the lofty goals when you see that. And as I say, that is, you know, what I try and do is point out what I think is obvious. I think it's fun in cartoons to point out things that are the truth, that it's hard for people to write about in a news story. It's hard for people to synthesized down in a column, but in a cartoon you really have to get to the point immediately, so you can really point stuff out in a very brutal way, which is at the same time is why they call it the ungentlemanly art of editorial cartooning.
Well, have you ever gotten any politicians or others who called you and said, hey, look, you went a little too far?
Well, people write or call quite a bit. The funny thing about politicians is basically I've drawn hundreds and hundreds of cartoons of politicians, and many of them were not very flattering. And you would be amazed at how many of them have called me up and asked me for the original to hang in their office. And it's always astounding to me, but it's true. And they like the cartoon. I've had politicians call me up and they disagree with what I've said about them in the cartoon, but they respect the craft of cartooning. They'd like the cartoon signed. It's very interesting. But the political dialogue is so harsh now. And with, you know, with the Internet and with anonymous commenters, it can be quite harsh. And I enjoy the dialogue. I don't expect people to agree with all of my cartoons at all. And I've had lots and lots and lots of people call me up over the years. And, you know, the general rule is let's not scream at each other, but I'm more than happy to hear your point of view. And we generally have civil discussions about the issues. And I find it interesting, and I think they do as well. And many times people have called up with a big head of steam, and they're ready to scream and yell. And by the end of the conversation, you know, they say, you know, I generally like your work, and then we can agree to disagree on this one. And it's a part of the democratic process. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, cartooning has a long history, so I find that part of it very rewarding when I get a chance to talk to readers, whether they're angry or calling up to compliment. It's interesting to talk to people and hear their point of view on the issues and on the cartoons.
Well, as you stated, you're an equal opportunity offender if you do offend, and sometimes with political satire, that's part of the package. Here's one that you did for Newsday about Dick Cheney stating that the U.S. Would be greeted as liberators and treated as heroes when we as a country invaded Iraq. Here's one, Cheney saying to Bush, "We'll be greeted with flowers." And then the next one has the two of them with flowers, and it says, "Yippee, you're leaving." Biting, but you made a good point.
Well, that was a long, sad. I found myself post 9/11 living in New York, really supporting the initial going into Iraq. I thought all the evidence was there. It's harder years later to remember what the country really felt like, but it was a very, very scary time, not just in New York, but everywhere. And when you have folks like Colin Powell and the folks in the Clinton administration, from folks looking at the intel on the ground saying, you know, there's some bad stuff here and we really need to do something about it. Now, again, trying to, you know, as a cartoonist and as someone who tries to look at stuff and synthesize down big issues, you know, when we were there for just a couple of months and realized there were no weapons, that was a big disappointment. That was shocking. And I think it became pretty clear that we had made a mistake. But on we went, and thousands of folks were killed, heroically trying to do what they were told to do. But, I think that was a very bad time, and I think we took our eye off the ball and so I thought that the neocons and Bush and Cheney deserved lots and lots of criticism for that.
You focus, of course, on features of people you draw, and most editorial cartoonists, you included, have had a lot of fun with the president's ears. they do stand
and
out.
And the former president.
That's true.
George Bush's. But two presidents in a row with big ears.
And Clinton, you didn't have big ears, but you had a big face with a kind of a bulbous nose. So you had some fun with him, too.
Well, Bill Clinton, you know, was very cartoonish in many ways. And I happened to be in New Orleans when the whole Monica Lewinsky started. And that was just... that was an unbelievable time to be a cartoonist, because cartoonists are really always trying to push the envelope. What can we say? We all work for family newspapers. We're not trying to be too cute by half and be salacious. But you'd wake up in the morning and read the paper, and just the news articles were unbelievable. So got away with a lot of fun stuff on the Clinton. During the Clinton second term. But yes, Clinton had a bulbous nose and a long sort of a Jay Leno chin and a puffy hair. he was preceded by President Bush I, who had a very angular face, very sharp features. So all of them are somewhat fun to draw. After a period of time, when you get used to it and your readers see how you're exaggerating them and you can stop putting little labels on them.
Among Louisiana politicos, who's been the most fun to draw?
Well, you know, I've just landed back into town, but I think, I've drawn Mitch Landrieu once, who's fun to draw. He's obviously shaves his head or keeps it very closely cropped, so he's got a big round head and a long chin, kind of a big, strong-looking guy. I've drawn the governor once in a column for Smiley Anders year in review piece, so I haven't had a chance to do that again yet. You know, I drew Edwards and his wife in another piece for Smiley about their reality show being canceled.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there'll be plenty more as time goes on and as things bubble up, and the, you know, we'll have a governor's race, and just had the mayor's race here.
Yeah, and the, so, Mitch Landrieu, since you mentioned it, he won going away, and he's going to be on the scene for a while, as is his sister, who's running for re-election. Among national figures, there's a question from a listener, Diane. She asks about Chris Christie. He would be a fun guy to draw for 4 years or 8 years or whatever. He's the kind of guy you live for, isn't he?
Chris Christie's fun to draw, you know, and I've drawn him several times when I was there up in New York, and obviously drew him a couple of times after this this bridge scandal that happened recently. So he'd be great. Hillary, not quite as easy to draw, but I think that would be a very interesting race and would be fun to draw cartoons and do animations about for sure. They both have very big personalities. They're both very well known, and now they're both, you know, they both have some baggage that they'll be carrying around, which makes it a little bit easier to come up with metaphors for the issues they'll be dealing with. And really, what we're, you know, what you look at with cartooning is because we deal so much in metaphor, you're looking for things, whether it's Chris Christie's size. Now there will be dozens of cartoons, no matter how deep he goes into the presidential race, if he goes at all, dealing with bridges. That will be a major theme for years with him. And for Hillary, the theme for a long time will be Benghazi. And there'll be a million cartoons with the punchline, what difference does it make? And there'll be cartoons about Bill being Bill being a house husband if she wins.
Right.
So all of these things are set in, they're set in motion already. I think, you know, for the next few weeks, you're going to see a lot of cartoons about the Olympics. And maybe they won't be specifically about the Olympics, but they'll be about, you know, I'm probably going to do a cartoon or a few cartoons where you can use these great Olympic events as metaphors for other issues. It's just a lot of fun to combine the two issues. And, of course, obviously, we'll all keep our fingers crossed that there is no terror attack over there. That's another big worry for folks, and should be.
Well, we're glad you're back home, and appreciate your time this morning. And Walt Handelsman is among the best. It's always hard to measure artistic talent, but he has it, and he's doing his thing right here in Louisiana for the Baton Rouge and New Orleans Advocate. Thank you for talking with us this morning, Walt Handelsman.
Thank you very much, Jim. It is a pleasure to be back, and I'm thrilled to be able to reach the readers in Baton Rouge and New Orleans and the state of Louisiana. It's just a great, great place to live, and happy to have my family here as well.
Let's talk soon. Thank you all.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Frank Barnett producing today, 297-5633. Your number outside the area, 877-217-5757. We're joined by the Director of Media Relations for Southern University, Edward Pratt, who for many years has written for the Baton Rouge Advocate, an editor, and now still a columnist on Saturdays with the Advocate. Good morning, Ed Pratt.
Good morning. How are you doing, Jim?
Doing well. And before we talk about Richard Sherman and your column about him and the Seattle blowout of Denver, 43-8, Aeneas Williams, Southern University, Pro Football Hall of Fame.
You know, that is awesome, and it's kind of late in coming, I think, even though it's his third time, just his third time up. I thought he should have been a first ballot Hall of Famer. The guy had all of the statistics to get in, 55 interceptions, 9 for touchdowns. The guy had almost 800 tackles, so he was a complete football player. He made the Pro Bowl 8 times, the All-Pro team 4 times. I mean, he was all-decade 1990s. I mean, what more did you want from him? And his off-the-field character was just, it was unmatched. The guy's a minister, a good family man, businessman. He did it all, and he did it quietly. And I think that's maybe what hurt him on the first two ballots.
14 years in the NFL, Aeneas Williams, who played at Southern, although he did not play football until his junior year in college, went to Forche High in New Orleans, a school that I don't believe is in existence.
Doesn't exist anymore. Yeah.
But you know that school produced Russell Long, David Treen, John Kennedy Toole, Howard K. Smith, and Aeneas Williams. And I will bet anybody that no school in America, no high school, has produced a Pulitzer Prize winner, a Pro Football Hall of Famer, a network anchorman, a governor, and a U.S. senator. But Forche High School in New Orleans did just that, and Aeneas Williams joins Mel Blount in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Southern has 2, LSU has 3, Grambling has 4 members of the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Southern with 2 has many more than many major colleges and several teams on the LSU football schedule. LSU this year will play New Mexico State, Sam Houston State, and UL Monroe. Why not Southern, Ed Pratt? Why don't the Tigers play the Jaguars?
Well, I'm not pushing for that game, not because of any of the what could happen, anything like that. I think Southern does well where we play, but if LSU will play us and we get $1 million out of it, I might be in favor of that. It would be good too to see the halftime show down there, to see the Golden Band from Tigerland, and then watch our band, the Human Jukebox, get on the field down there. And I think that would be worth the price of admission. But I said, if you give us $1 million, I think we'll get in the bus and come on over.
Well, how about playing in Memorial Stadium and charging $500 a ticket?
Maybe so. Maybe
a neutral site. A neutral site. It's where Southern used to play.
Yeah, we played there for I think 2 years, where we were remodeling the remodeling the stadium. I know when I was in school here, we did that at least once or twice.
You know, I think Terry Bradshaw played his last college football game at Memorial Stadium in the Grantland Rice Bowl for Louisiana Tech.
And they played Tennessee State.
And he threw 5 interceptions. But he's an NFL Hall of Famer, a Pro Football Hall of Famer from Louisiana Tech. Southern also has the only baseball Hall of Famer among Louisiana colleges in Lou Brock.
Lou Brock. Sweet Lou Brock.
That's right. So Southern has as many baseball and football Hall of Famers as does LSU, and doesn't get the acclaim it should. And Southern has a great tradition in athletics and in other endeavors. But yesterday, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I hope the media all around is listening to that, what you're saying about how wonderful our athletes are. And we don't stop there. We have a basketball player in the Hall of Fame also. Bob Love.
Bob Love, who played for the Chicago Bulls, and this was long before Michael Jordan, a great player, had a terrible stuttering problem that he's largely overcome. And Rudy Macklin, Saturday at the Hill Memorial Library, was talking about how he had a stuttering problem when he came to LSU, and he not only learned how to play basketball in a much better way for the Fighting Tigers, but LSU worked on his stuttering, and it enabled him to have jobs and to do things that he otherwise would not have done. And I was listening to him, a very articulate man, and he was there for about an hour with Coach Dale Brown, a little over an hour. Not one time did Rudy Macklin say, you know. Well, yesterday, the Seattle Seahawks blew out the biggest beatdown in a big game since Alabama beat LSU 21-0 January 9th, 2012 in the Superdome for the BCS title, 43-8. Richard Sherman, who came in as the most ballyhooed player and criticized, the cornerback, all-pro for Seattle, got hurt, but he had a good game. They just weren't throwing in his direction, but do you think, Ed Pratt, based on your column, that the criticism he received for mouthing off after the victory over San Francisco was justified?
I think it was much overblown. I think here's a guy that comes off of one of the greatest plays that he has had in his career. It took his team from the playoffs to the Super Bowl, where all young football players or old football players want to go. And he was jacked up after the game. Now, how he expressed himself may have been off-putting to some people, but the things that he didn't do, he didn't curse. He didn't do anything untoward to anybody, didn't do anything unnecessary to any other players or something on the field. He was loud. And that's okay, but the storm that came after that, and even some of it that was in my mind and other people's mind was racially motivated, came an attack on him. And you know, I'm not one of those people who say, "Well, look at his character, look at his background, and all that." I mean, he's a Stanford grad. He was an honor student in high school. All those things are good, but you can be crazy and smart at the same time. I'm not saying he was, but I'm just saying that I don't use that to base what I did when I wrote my column. I wrote my column basically on what happened at that time. I just think it was unjustified, the amount of criticism that he took. And I think, you know, I think too is that there were some people who were pulling for another team, and all of that kind of stuff was there. And then the media was able to, the sports writers and all were able to build this this good guy versus bad guy type of thing with Peyton Manning and Richard Sherman for the Super Bowl. So it sort of worked out in the buildup for the game.
Well, we'll get to that as well, but you're right. If Sherman didn't have dreadlocks, many folks might have let his rant go after a day or so, and maybe if he wasn't talking to the lovely and white Aaron Andrews, some of his racist comments, right?
Well, you know, even after I wrote my column,
some of the racist comments might not.
I had that in my column. Someone, I got a lot of emails, and one of them called me, saying that you must be, and they put it on there, N thug, and so I knew exactly what they were meaning by that, and I may have gotten a couple emails that sort of mentioned that just on. The basis of my writing my column, but also my column has a picture with it, so they tend to know who and what I look like. So, you take a little bit of that, and I think in the 2 weeks after the playoff game, I think the public sort of calmed down a little bit once they listened to him in other interviews. And he also said after the game, later that day, that he apologized for his rant, and what else could he do?
Well, I don't know why he needed to apologize. Muhammad Ali never apologized.
Right.
And, you know, that sells tickets.
It sells tickets, and it makes people who may not be interested in the game sort of take an interest and say, who is this guy? But just as I put in my column, I don't think what he did as far as talking about, you know, his big play and his opposing team and the opposing team as what Tom Brady did, running off the field cursing a referee, and that was just sort of let go. What's worse? So it depends on, you know, if somebody believes that a guy is a hero or he has a good public image, we tend to let those things go. And as you said earlier, and also I said in my column, Sherman had dreadlocks. He doesn't look like your hero, and that scares some people.
Well, and the narrative sometimes is such that information that might change that narrative is never mentioned. And I mentioned about Peyton Manning being sued successfully by a doctor at the University of Tennessee who examined him, a female doctor who purportedly was victimized by Peyton Manning, who pulled down his shorts and sat on her head and face. That is never mentioned except in places like this on rare occasions. And Peyton Manning, if he had been Jordan Jefferson, he probably would have been tried in court over this. But instead, they named a road after him in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Yep.
297-5633, Charles on North Foster. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning, Jim, and good morning to you. Yes, I'm a Southern University graduate, and I just wanted to ask, I guess, two quick questions. One is, Where's the SWAC heading, and do you see any real benefit for HBCUs remaining a part of the NCAA? They seem to be shut out of the big money contracts. And the other thing about Richard Sherman, no one touches on that the guy who was coaching against him across the field was his old college coach who tried to cut him off the team. Had it not been for assistant coaches, he would have put Mr. Sherman off the team. So there were some other underlying issues, including him and Mr. Crabtree in offseason having some Twitter interaction before the game. I'll hang up and listen.
Well, as far as Southern and the HBCUs and contracts, that's above my pay grade about whether Southern will get out of the NCAA. There are benefits to be in the NCAA, even for HBCUs. Just that HBCUs have to be smart about what they, how they use their money, how they raise money in athletics, and how they play the games, where they play the games. Whether we will go to whether there are any big paydays out there for HBCUs, as I said before, you have to figure out how you're going to play, who you're going to play. Of course, we'll never have the paydays that, let's say, that LSU have. You're just not in that category. But you can make paydays with classics that we have, and also playing some of those big schools occasionally. I know a lot of people are not in favor of that because they're basically money games or body bag games, whatever you want to call them. But you have to play those games now and then to make sure you have money in the coffers of your athletic department. It's just one of the ills of how things go now.
Well, if LSU is going to play Louisiana Tech, UL Monroe, UL Lafayette, Tulane, Northwestern State, McNeese State, as they have in the last several years, Southern University is a no-brainer. The baseball team plays Southern. The basketball team has played Southern. There's no reason not to play Southern University. And LSU should pony up, play Southern, and it would be a spectacle. And I guarantee you there wouldn't be 20,000 or 30,000 empty seats in Tiger Stadium for that
I can guarantee that also.
Well, Lou Ellen asked the question about, I mentioned Peyton Manning and his problems at the University of Tennessee. She says, why do the media not report about Drew Brees suing his own mother? And Drew Brees did sue his mother, and that's something that is rarely, if ever, reported anymore. It's because we want these guys who are great quarterbacks like Brees and Manning to somehow be great human beings, which they may be, but like the rest of us, sometimes they have foibles that they don't like to talk about, and the media are complicit in not having them talk about it. Why doesn't somebody ask a question at a Super Bowl to one of these guys like Brees or Manning about some of their past problems?
Well, I agree with you. I agree with you on that. But it's sort of like an old boys community there among those the sports writers and all of those things. Now, they sort of pick who are the good guys, and that's who they go with. They don't want to step on any toes. They want to be able to interview that guy. They want to be able to come to his house and interview him. They want him on their talk shows. And they know if they mention those things, he won't be on their talk shows or whatever quarterback or running back or whoever it is.
Right.
That person will not be on their talk shows. They won't be able to get into the press box. They won't be able to go to the suites. They won't be able to go to the after game parties and all those type of things and meet with these type of people. And so that's what they do. They don't mind the bad guys. The bad guys are easy because they probably won't be wanting to talk to this guy away from the football field at all. So they will go after the so-called bad guy and write those stories and that sort of thing.
What kind of a man sues his own mother?
Yes.
Well, it's somehow, and I'll say it, I think you're skirting around the edges here. Usually the bad guy, as in Richard Sherman, is black, and the good guy, as in Peyton Manning, he's white. That's not a coincidence, is it?
No, and it's as I said in my column, I remember when when tattoos became controversial in the NBA. And they were saying how horrible the NBA is getting with all of these players with the tattoos, and those players were African American. Then when other players started to wear the tattoos, and when I say other players, non-black players, well that was no longer an issue, and it was okay. And you don't hear that conversation about tattoos anymore. And it goes on and on with other parts of athletics. You know, the players who are loud, it's okay for certain other ethnic group players to be loud, but if an African-American player is loud, then somehow he is vilified. And it's just the way it is. It's not the right way it should be, but life is not fair, and that's what happened.
Well, tomorrow we'll resume this conversation with Jesse Ventura. Speaking of loud and brash, he's been known to be that way. And Ed, enjoy your work every Saturday in the Baton Rouge and now New Orleans Advocate. And hopefully we'll have Southern and LSU tee it up at Tiger Stadium or Memorial Stadium sometime.
Give us a million dollars. We'll be there.
Okay. Thank you, Ed. Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye. We'll be back tomorrow. Jesse Ventura, one of the guests, along with Manuel Martinez. Until then, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.